Let's begin by just talking about the book itself here. What gave you the motivation or inspiration to write Nonviolent Action?
Well, the basic idea of the book, and certainly this is the context of my motivation too, is that in the last 50 years, there have been enormous nonviolent campaigns for peace and justice, campaigns against injustice and oppression that have been stunningly successful. Scholars who study this say that these campaigns have been far more successful in the last 50 years than ever before. Whether it's Gandhi overcoming the British Empire, or Martin Luther King changing American history, or in Poland and East Germany, stunning nonviolent campaigns against Marxist totalitarians that everybody said could only be overthrown violently, and nobody expected that in any kind of reasonable future, nonviolent campaigns succeeded. Or in the Philippines, a couple decade long dictator Marcos was overthrown through a nonviolent campaign with the nuns going out into the streets and other nuns praying. So there's just this stunning success of nonviolent campaigns, and that raises the question, what could we really do nonviolently if we got serious about using this technique? Because we've not invested significant funds in training or studying the examples of nonviolent success. So my interest is, what would happen if we really took this technique seriously?
Well, I think a lot of people have some assumptions and maybe some stereotypes about what this means. They might say, well, we can't just sit back passively and do nothing. Let's define this for listeners. How are you defining nonviolent action?
Well, I agree vigorously that we can't just sit back passively. In fact, Gandhi, one of the most famous practitioners of nonviolence, said, if the only two choices are standing by idly while other people are oppressed or killed, or using violence, then of course you use violence. But Gandhi's point was there's always a third alternative, which is to engage nonviolently. So nonviolence is an activist kind of intervention in situations of injustice, oppression, dictatorship, in a way that enables you to even love the oppressor while you continue to challenge the oppression and say we won't tolerate it, and in fact we'll put ourselves on the line to challenge and defy your oppression. And the successful examples regularly involve large numbers of people who march nonviolently. They don't use violence, but they call attention to the oppression and, in fact, get in the way so that the oppression can't really continue unless the oppressor uses lethal violence and kills people. And sometimes they do, but often precisely that brutal action evokes the sympathy of bystanders who then support the nonviolent campaigners and they eventually win.
Now, when you were talking about your motivation for writing the book, you briefly mentioned a couple of examples. Can you sketch a couple of historical examples of this nonviolent action that has been successful?
Yeah, we all sort of know about Gandhi and the way that his nonviolent campaign defeated the British Empire eventually, and, of course, Martin Luther King's stunning nonviolent civil rights movement now being brought to our attention again with the popular movie Selma. But let me tell you a different story. In the Philippines, in the 70s and 80s, there was a long-standing dictator, brutal Ferdinand Marcos, and people thought that probably the only way to get rid of him would be a 10-year violent campaign that would be incredibly destructive. But then there was an election after he had killed one of his strongest opponents massacred him at the airport when he came back from the United States. And his widow ran in an election and clearly won the campaign. But, of course, the dictator used his power to claim that he had won. And at that point, the Catholic cardinal called the people out into the streets, and a million or two people just flooded the streets. And the dictator, you know, sent in his tanks, and there are amazing stories of how the tanks, you know, stopped in front of praying nuns, an old woman, I think an 80-year-old in a wheelchair, just right in front of the tanks, and they would lurch forward an inch or two and then stop. They couldn't bring themselves to crush all of these people. And eventually the dictator fled, and the election was declared in the favor of Mrs. Aquino, and the dictator was defeated.
Now, when you and I were talking before we began the podcast, you mentioned that there are even Muslims who've been involved in nonviolent action. I think our readers would be greatly interested in hearing a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, one of the most amazing things about Gandhi's campaign is that, to Gandhi's surprise, actually, as he organized mostly Hindu people in India to take part in his nonviolent campaign against the British to work for independence, a Muslim leader in the Northwest province, it's the area where we now read in the newspapers about the Taliban in the northwest part of Pakistan, and then, of course, in Afghanistan. And a Muslim leader there by the name of Bacha Khan organized really the first nonviolent peace army. He organized a group with officers and special uniforms and a bugle corps. Eventually, it swelled to 80,000, and they were all totally committed to nonviolence. When Gandhi's assault campaign began in 1930, they supported it completely. And the British tried desperately to destroy Bacha Khan's Muslim nonviolent army. They actually, one day, they killed a couple hundred people, and they actually threw some of the people in human excrement after they'd beaten them. They did everything they could to provoke them to violence, but they persisted and were a crucial part of Gandhi's campaign. And even when independence was finally won and hostilities broke out between Muslims and Hindus, this nonviolent Muslim army was there to intervene and protect everyone. The biographer of Bacha Khan actually says that one of the interesting things is that this particular set of group people that we now know as the Taliban, of course, had a long, long history of being violent. Prominent people like Nehru said that these people loved their gun better than their child or family. They were just known for vicious violence. And Bacha Khan's biographer says that if you can organize nonviolence among these people, then it can be done in any country on earth.
Mm-hmm. Now, in amongst contemporary Christians, this is not a majority strategy. It's not very well supported. What would you say to Christian critics of nonviolent action who many times support U.S. military action in the name of just war doctrine?
Well, one of the central arguments of my book is right here. I'm not arguing in this book that this is just something that pacifists do. In fact, my point is that the ethical arguments of both just war Christians and pacifist Christians require a lot more serious exploration of precisely this kind of action. Just war Christians, and that's, of course, the majority view in the Christian church since Constantine in the early 4th century, just war Christians say that war has to be a last resort. Just war Christians have a whole variety of of criteria for deciding whether a war would be just. And one of the basic ones is it must be a last resort, which means that you must have tried all the reasonable nonviolent alternatives. Well, we live at a time when there have been hundreds and hundreds of successful nonviolent campaigns. In fact, there's just recently been a scholarly study of about 300 of the most important both violent and nonviolent campaigns in the last 100 years. And these scholars do a careful statistical analysis and discover that the nonviolent campaigns have been more successful and more likely to lead to democratic futures. More successful, that is, they succeeded in their objectives more often than the violent campaigns. So my point is that if just war people are really serious about their criterion of last resort, then, of course, at a time when we now know that nonviolence is stunningly successful and often works, we have to, if we take the just war criterion seriously, invest a large amount of money and train a whole bunch of people in the techniques of nonviolence in order to find out how much we really can do by nonviolent techniques. Just war people don't have to give up their belief that sometimes war is necessary or violence is necessary, but they really have to take their own principle seriously that it has to be a last resort. And then as far as pacifists are concerned, they've said for a long time they've got an alternative to war and killing. Well, if that's true, they better put themselves on the line in the same way that soldiers do in order to demonstrate that nonviolence works. So my point is, Christians of all sorts really have to, at this point in history, invest a lot more money and time and resources in nonviolent campaigns if their own ethical commitments are to be taken seriously at all.
One of the areas I've been studying lately in my personal reflections on Jesus and the Gospels is his call for love of enemy and his examples and teachings on nonviolence. I think it's, in my opinion, it's difficult to make a theological case from Jesus that he did not practice nonviolence. Why do you think these aspects of his life and ministry have been at least marginalized among American Christians? Why has there been such large and seemingly quick support for U.S. military action around the world?
Well, I think that the call to love your enemies is a hard call. It's certainly not a natural response to enemies. It requires something very different than what we instinctively do. But I think what's really important for Christians is to see that this call to love your enemies is not just something that pacifists take seriously, although obviously pacifists think it's important and central to Jesus' teaching, but all Christians agree that this is one of the things he taught and that loving your enemies applies to everyone. So people in the just war tradition, if they're going to be serious at all about following Jesus, have to ask, what does it mean as a Christian to love my enemies? And at the very least, it means in the just war tradition to, in fact, explore the possibilities of nonviolence so that we take seriously the criterion of last resort. Now, some Christians have argued that you can kill your enemies and still love them. St. Augustine said that. I have I find it somewhat difficult to think that really is possible. But my basic point here is Jesus' command to love one's enemies, Jesus' command for Christians to be peacemakers, is not just something that applies to pacifist Christians. It applies equally to all Christians.
Right now, the international headlines in the news and the media are frequently focused on the violence going on in various parts of the world in the form of religious terrorism or religiously inspired terrorism. Do you think nonviolence should be applied in these contexts in response to terrorism?
Well, I'm not claiming in the book that nonviolent intervention always has an instant, easy solution to every situation. And it's certainly the case that some of the terrorists, like the Islamic State now in Syria, Iraq, you know, is incredibly vicious and astonishingly atrocious. What I'm saying is that, in fact, far more often than we think, nonviolence works, And so we ought to be testing it far more than we should. And I like to say that, take for example, the situation as the state of Yugoslavia collapsed in the 1990s, and there was terrible both ethnic and religious killing as Serbs who were Orthodox Christians and people in part of Yugoslavia who were Muslims, you know, slaughtered each other. Now, if there had been 1,000 Christians and Muslims led by top Orthodox Christians and top Catholic Christians and Protestant Christians too, as well as Muslim leaders, if they had marched in saying we come as people praying and believing in one God, and you can kill us if you want to, but we're going to stay here until you stop killing each other. I think again and again and again, that kind of nonviolent army of the sort that the Muslim Bhatia Khan had in the northwest frontier of India when Gandhi was doing his civil disobedience campaign, that kind of army could in fact reduce violence and killing in dramatic sorts of ways.
In your own work, have you seen any kind of growing interest among Christians in exploring nonviolence? And if there are listeners who are intrigued about this and want to learn more and get involved in ministry that incorporates nonviolence, how might they do that?
Oh, yeah, no question. In the last several decades, more and more Christian leaders and organizations have spoken very positively of nonviolent campaigns. I outline these in one section of my book, but the World Council of Churches has made statements, the National Council of Churches, Presbyterians, the U.S. Catholic bishops in their peace pastoral and in their 10-year update on that. So a whole bunch of Christian leaders in new kinds of ways have done that. The National Association of Evangelicals has as their official public policy platform a document called For the Health of the Nation, and one of the sections is on peace and peacemaking, and that statement explicitly calls for more exploration of nonviolent action and indicates that you know, governments and Christians are to take that seriously.
Is there anything I missed?
Yes. One more thing on that, and as people can go to the Christian Peacemaker Team's website online. That's one example. Christian Peacemaker Teams. That's one example of a growing organization of Christians. There are also groups like Peace Brigades International. That's not particularly specifically religious. There's the Muslim. There's a Muslim Peacemaker Team, although that's not very active. Although it's been developed a bit, modeled after Christian peacemaker teams. And there's an ecumenical accompaniment program that works in the West Bank to try to help Palestinians who are threatened by Israelis that with some frequency you know, act violently against them. So there are a number of organizations that are out there, and people can explore that.
It's good to know. Have I missed anything? Is there anything else you'd like to add that you'd like listeners to be aware of regarding this issue in your book?
I think the important thing is that there is growing interest in this, although it's still the case that we've invested very, very little. You know, we invest tens of billions of dollars every year in training people for the military and very careful, sophisticated studies of what works and what doesn't. Surely we ought to invest for a decade or two, at least a tenth as much, in studying the amazing success of nonviolent campaigns and what works best, and then training literally thousands of people to, in fact, use nonviolence wherever that has the possibility of succeeding.
Dr. Sider, thank you so much for carving out some time and for your wonderful book. Again, it's Nonviolent Action, What Christian Ethics Demands, But Most Christians Have Never Really Tried. Dr. Sider, thank you.
Thank you, gladly, and blessings in your work to try to bring growing understanding and peace among different groups of people and religious organizations around the world.
Great. I will edit this, and I will send you a link in case you'd like to let other folks know about it, and we will promote it in our via our email network, and hopefully we will draw some attention to your book.
Good. Thanks.